Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
So, again, Joe, we are going to have this Slido poll going during this presentation. If you go to slido.com, if you didn't receive the email, I got the email and I put in what I do, but I'm not divulging that on the show, whether I scavenge or not. I'd rather get other people's opinions on that, which is why we're doing the poll.
I like
that. Go to slido.com and it's perfweb C30-8. That's our event code. One question, it'll take you less than 5 seconds to answer it. We'd really love to have your input during the
If you got to think about it, then we've got a big problem. Yeah. If it takes you more than just a couple of seconds to answer this question. Like, what is the exhaust? Is there an exhaust port on the oxygen? If you have to ask yourself that, stop doing what you're doing.
Yeah, well, and I may know why that happened. So so we're going to get into all that.
All right,
so,
good.
All right. So just, I'm not going to go into big history of inhalant, anesthesia gases, but I thought this was interesting. The first documented case of actually anesthetizing somebody and rendering them knocked out during surgery was back in 1846. This man down here, John Collins Warren, he's the one holding the skull for his LinkedIn picture, I guess.
He looks sinister, dude.
Yes, I know. He was the first one to document this, and what they did is they administered ether, you know, probably through a towel to this poor young man here, which it looks like they're still holding him down, and they extracted a tooth. But he doesn't remember any of this happening, so it was better than whiskey. One of the problems with ether, though, is that it is nice and short-acting, but it's extremely flammable. And you know these guys here were back in 1846 smoking cigars and pipes and things, and there were a lot of fires in the operating rooms, fires and explosions. So that was a problem. So things moved on, and nowadays we have what are called halogenated anesthetics. And there are more than just these three. But these are the three most recent that I could find. Some of them we're using. I had used desflurane years ago. But the process...
I used to use halothane.
Halothane was one of them, but that's so old I didn't even include it. Mm-hmm. But yes, it is definitely in the same class. And it really, they're all very similar in the way they act, but they've been making improvements over the years. So what happens here is they take ether, basically, and they do put it through a halogenation process, which is removing a hydrogen atom and replacing it with some other kind of an atom. In this case, for these inhalation agents, they're adding a fluorine atom. You can add different kinds of atoms. So these types of chemicals are also used for refrigeration, for industrial heat pumps and things like that, but they're used in all kinds of ways. But for our purposes, they're using a fluorine atom, which is why we ended up with these names, isoflurane, desflurane, and sevoflurane. So sevoflurane is the newest one. And sevoflurane is beneficial in the way that, and this is something I did not know, is that it causes depression of the cerebral metabolic requirements.
Really?
And so, yep. Okay. So it's beneficial while you're on pump in that way to use sevoflurane, and that's one of the newer ones.
In particular,
ones.
For maybe deep hypothermia, circulatory arrest, get when you're cooling,
yeah,
having it on would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Desflurane is an older one, and I used that years ago when I first started. Desflurane is, and I remember it being this way. One of the reasons people liked that so much, and some people still may be using it, is that it has an extremely quick onset and an extremely quick offset. You turn it down, and I mean, if you overdo it a little bit, you're gonna be right back where you were once you adjust your mm-hmm. gas, way faster than the sevoflurane or isoflurane.
Yeah, I used to use it for pressure control.
Sure, of course.
So the pressure would get kind of high on pump, and I'd just reach over, and say, even if I gave too much Neo or something, I'd just crank it up,
yeah,
let it run for a minute, turn it back down again, and pressure would just come right back down.
Do you remember halothane and how that, was it different than these?
I it's been a long time ago since I used halothane, but I don't ever remember. I think I did use it like that, but we were always very scared of halothane, if I remember correctly, because it seemed to have so much cardiac depressive effect.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so
right.
We would turn it off really early.
Mm-hmm.
and then come off pump.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely why, and that's, you led me right into the last one here. Isoflurane is the most commonly used today, and one of the reasons is that it has minimal cardiac effects. But it also has the same effect as the sevoflurane as far as reducing the cerebral metabolic needs.
Oh, that's
so
good.
Those two are real similar and used probably the most these days.
Mm-hmm.
But isoflurane being the most. And something I'm going to touch on a little bit later down the line here is that these chemicals, especially the desflurane, they stay around in the atmosphere for about 150 years, and they don't go away, and they're extremely powerful greenhouse gases. So,
really?
And I'm going to go through some of that. I didn't know this until I did this research. But
wow. Yeah. 150 years.
So far. They only started using them 150 years
okay.
ago. So they could be forever.
Okay.
But they're still around. They're still in the atmosphere, and, you know, they don't know how long they last, but they go for a long time. So this is the best part of what I learned. You know, what do these gases really, how do they affect people in the room? Because we're really talking about either scavenging or not scavenging. And I guess, as they used to say back in the 90s, they'd say, y'all ready for this? Because there's a list. They can cause chronic nausea, chronic dizziness, chronic fatigue, and you thought it was the job, right?
Yeah.
Chronic headaches, chronic irritability. You seem all right. How long has it been since you did a case? Reduced mental performance. And remember that the perfusionist is sitting right by the oxygenator, right?
Yeah.
And I'll get to another part of this in just a second here. Chronic liver and kidney disease. Difficulties with judgment and coordination. And the cooties. Okay, it doesn't really cause the cooties, but if you've got the liver disease and the mental performance problems, people might think you have the cooties anyway, but I had to put that in there. For both men and women, sterility and infertility. For women, miscarriages and birth defects of several kinds.
Wow. Is there a concentration in which, you know, when you say long-term exposure,
mm-hmm.
long-term exposure to a particular concentration or long, like, what does long-term exposure mean?
Yeah, well, I don't think that's exactly defined, but we are using it at, you know, 1 or 2% during our procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, only 5 to 10% of what we put through our oxygenator is metabolized by the patient. So 90% of it is going out into the air.
Wow.
In the room.
Wow.
Which is surprising that you don't smell it more. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, because I rarely smell it unless I turn it up real high for whatever reason or the gas is leaking or something. But I do feel bad about the years ago when there'd be younger people learning to run the pump and such, and I'd like pull off the oxygen line before we started and turn the SIVO up to, you know, 10% and say, can you see and smell if this is working or not?
Mm-hmm.
Had I known all this, I wouldn't have done that.
Well, that wasn't nice, but I'll tell you what one of my instructors did to me. He made me take a big breath of 95.5.
Ooh, really?
That had a very bad effect. It burned really bad, but I got really dizzy.
Yeah.
It was bad.
So the next question is, let's go back to this. Where do these gases go? Most of them go into the room unless you're scavenging them. If you are scavenging them, you know, there's a couple ways to do that, and I'm going to touch that on that in just a minute. But, you know, I've become convinced that I'm going to scavenge every case. There are cases I do, there are cases I don't. I guess I'll admit it. But I'm going to scavenge every case because,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you said, 25 years is a long time to be, you know, behind the pump there and to be breathing these things that we know can be causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we the most documented problems are with the, you know, with the miscarrages, mm-hmm. and the early births.
And don't let me get ahead. If I'm getting ahead of you, just say something. But I mean, do we have any guidance from, like, does JCO have any guidance? Does
they
AMSECT
do.
Have any guidance? Okay, so
they
I'm
do,
getting
yeah.
ahead of you.
Okay, yeah,
so
that's
let me
okay.
let me
no,
let
that's
you
fine.
Go through
yeah.
that.
That only means I prepared well. So, the National Institute, I'm going to mess up their name.
Of Occupational Safety and Health.
Yeah, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which is a center, which is a division of the CDC, which we're all hearing a lot about that now, you know, because of the coronavirus and such. What they recommend is that all of these systems that you install a scavenging system in the operating room, and that the exhaust goes into, you know, a waste area, that it's not reintroduced into the facility. Train all workers on the awareness and the hazards. But look at this. On the bottom here, they recommend that we obtain a baseline liver and kidney function of the people working in the operating room, and then track that over time.
Really?
Which, that's, you know, it means we're really looking at something that should be looked at a little more closely. And then there's JACO, one of our favorite organizations. I got this picture not long ago, so I thought that was kind of funny. Make sure we follow the guidelines when they're in-house. But they also recommend a scavenging system should be installed. But they say it's the responsibility of the institution to organize and document the maintenance of the equipment. And you know they're into documents. So it is possible that JACO could come and ask the perfusionist, you know, do you have documentation of your scavenging equipment being functional, and that is it working? You know, that sounds like the kind of question they might ask, right, mm-hmm. when they come to the hospital.
That's a good point.
And then there's our organization, or some people's organization, the AMSECT. You know, in their standards of practice, they have shoulds and shalls. Mm-hmm. And under this topic, they say that the gas shall be removed through a scavenging system off of the oxygener. So it's pretty clear there's no organization out there that says that we shouldn't be scavenging. They all say that we should. And
you would consider it a standard of care?
I would consider it a standard of care at this time. Mm. Would you?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely, 100%.
Have you always scavenged when
nope.
you were? No? Okay.
No, we never even thought about it. I mean, we used, we used bubble oxygenators.
Right.
When I started.
Can't do it that way,
right.
can you? Never thought of that.
No.
You
there's
can't.
No way to do
yeah,
it.
There's no way to do it.
Uh-uh.
Interesting. Huh. So then the question comes up, you know, why do perfusionists not scavenge? Because mm-hmm. there are many people who don't. And I think the main concern from talking to a few perfusionists on the phone and people we work with is that they're just worried that they're going to overpressurize the oxygenator. And it's one more thing to look at.
And if you do overpressurize the oxygenator, what happens?
I think the thought is that you're going to put bubbles through the membrane if you're using a semi-porous oxygenator.
Well, if you...
What do you think would happen? I've never tried it, so...
I think if you were on bypass with gas flow coming in and you had a line connected to your exhaust port on the oxygenator and you clamped it, you would have a massive air embolus of the patient and they would be dead rapidly.
Yeah,
I don't think it'd be bubbles.
Be foam, yeah.
I think you would just absolutely... The case is over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are ways around that. There's some systems out there to avoid that from happening. Mm-hmm. The most notable one is a Y, which I'll show everybody, but I think that's the most common way, is a mm-hmm. Y off of the oxygenator. And the oxygenator that we're using has its own little extra port off to the side, so if you were to hook up one line, there's still an additional way for gas to escape, even if you were to clamp the line off or somebody mm-hmm. were to step on mm-hmm. it or something. Mm-hmm.
So it's built-in safety feature of the lungs that we, or the oxygenators that we
right.
use now.
Right, right. Yeah.
You have a picture of it? I hope you do.
I do.
Oh, good.
Yeah, not of the oxygenator, but I did want to talk a little bit about where these gases go. As I mentioned earlier on, only about 5 to 10% of the gases that we put through the oxygenator are are metabolized by the patient. The rest of them come out the other side of the oxygenator. And this is the same thing for the anesthesia machine. I spoke to some anesthesiologists that we work with. For them, with their ventilator, it's not even an option not to scavenge. That's just something that they do. I mean, they wouldn't even run the machine without having a scavenge port on mm-hmm. it. And it's interesting that it's not so cut and straight, you know, for perfusion, you mm-hmm. know, that there is question. You ask
shorter
people,
duration of time. It's, you know, anesthesia has, you know, so much more time that the patient is being managed by their anesthesia ventilator and, you know, mm-hmm. a machine. They do way more cases. You know, you have an operating room with 14 surgery rooms. You might only have one of them or two of them, maybe it tops as a heart surgery room. So, you know, there's that consideration too.
Yeah.
And then our contribution to it is short, you know, relatively.
Hours, yeah. A couple hours, yeah.
Well, sometimes.
Right.
It depends. I mean, some surgeons longer, some surgeons shorter.
Six, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. I get what you're saying, that's true. But it just is interesting that you know that like the National Institute for Occupational Health,
Safety and Health,
they, you know, they're really talking about, and they're not talking about perfusion in their recommendations, they're talking about anesthesia, but I don't see a big difference between, you know, it's the same gas. And it still would be escaping into the room if you're not scavenging it.
Agreed.
You know? And as a perfusionist, I mean, let's face it, you're sitting there right by the reservoir, hoping that thing doesn't drain, especially if you're, you know, 200 cc's from the bottom.
Right.
And you are right by the outlet of that oxygenator. You're right there.
You are.
If I was a female, I'd be even more concerned, you know?
But I'm concerned. A pregnant female.
I'd be really concerned if I was a pregnant female.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Very good points.
You know? And you never know, you know, who in the room is pregnant or trying to get pregnant. So it just seems to me, and that's not a question you're going to ask everybody before you go on bypass. So I say, you know, let's scavenge. You know, that's really where I'm leaning towards.
Mm-hmm.
But so there are two ways to get the gas out of your oxygenator. I mean, you're going to connect a line of some sort. Some people will use a Y like this. You know, Stephanie, who, you know, is our manager, our clinical manager, she had a video and talked a little bit about some different ways of scavenging. And I was hoping that she would call in. She said she might be able to call in and describe that system too. It was a little different than what I've seen. But you can use, some people are using the regular vacuum that you use for your cell saver, your wall suction.
Mm-hmm.
Couple things to keep in mind on that is that that's pulling about 15 liters off the wall, you know, 15 liters a minute. That's a lot of suction to pull across your membrane.
Absolutely.
So
too much,
yeah. Now if you have this Y, you know, that I've demonstrated here, you're going to have less than that, but still you should probably regulate that if you're going to be using wall suction. The other thing about wall suction is you ever wonder where this stuff goes? I mean, where does it go after it gets vacuumed out of the system?
You know, and
system?
I think you're going to tell me, I think I'm going to be surprised when you tell me this, but I assumed that it went through some type of filtration process and then eventually was released into the atmosphere is what I assumed, but that may not be accurate.
Well, I assumed the same thing. Actually, and it really does not. There is no recommendation. You know, when you look at how they're people who are recommending how to you know handle this stuff. If you're building this kind of a system, they don't recommend anything other than that you have the outlet of wherever all this suction from the operating room is. That outlet goes 10 feet from any hole into the facility. So being a door or inlet vent or something like that. So it really just goes right up into the air. And WAGD, some hospitals have this, and I noticed some of them don't. So the newer ones that we work at have that. WAGD stands for Waste Anesthesia Gas Disposal, specifically designed to remove these gases and not reintroduce them anywhere, you know, near the hospital. Some of these systems also just vent up into the atmosphere. Some of them use a recycling system because they can capture some of it, since we're only using 90% of the gas, and we know it's harmful.
You mean 10%?
I'm sorry, 10% of the gas. We're wasting 90%. We know that it's harmful to the atmosphere. These gases can be actually collected and reused.
Oh, wow.
Know? Yeah, strangely enough. Now, those systems cost something, so, you know, they're not widely used. But
does somebody
they're
buy
out there.
It?
So the hospital would buy it and use it when they build the hospital.
But what I'm saying is that if you take this waste disposal system
and
you're recycling it, and the hospital has to pay money to have the system installed.
Yes.
Can they then sell what is in the recycling container to someone, or is that just given away freely?
I don't know. It's a great question.
Because that would be
because if you could recoup the cost. I don't know what the cost of these gases are, honestly, if they're very valuable or not. I mean, we just ask anesthesia for a bottle of it and pour it in, and could be thousands of dollars. I really doubt it, but I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, you never know. But So I thought that was interesting, though. There are ways to scavenge this. Now, why would you why would you recycle it? I kind of touched on this earlier, but I just wanted to mention that. So desflurane is 20 times worse than the other two, our isoflurane and our sevoflurane, as far as greenhouse gas. And desflurane, so basically, if you calculate it out, isoflurane has the potential of 2,000 times more damage than CO2.
Wow.
Ounce per ounce. So desflurane, if you calculate that out, because it'd be 40,000 times worse than CO2. So if you look at the atmosphere and they analyze this, believe it or not, 10% of the greenhouse gases that are floating around out there are these gases. And it's not only the anesthesia gases. It's also the gases I mentioned that are, you know, halogenated to be used for, you know, refrigerants and heat pumps and things like that. But 10% is pretty big. All the vehicles in the world make about 29% of the CO2. So 10% is big. So, you know, it makes sense to recycle it if you can. Use it again, or at least dispose of it rather than throwing it up into the sky, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Especially when you think about all the other problems it can cause to us, you know, as humans.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what I have.
That's very good.
But
that was
excellent. Yeah, thank you.
I got a lot of questions.
Good. Questions, and then when we are ready, we can see the survey results.
Yeah, so I would like to see a picture of the oxygen, but you know, being concerned about overpressurization of the gas phase of the oxygenator is a very real and serious concern. Having it over vacuumed would probably, I don't think you could pull blood across. Those pore sizes of a membrane are like really small, like in the angstrom size. They're really teeny. I can't remember the exact size, but they're really teeny. So I don't think you pull blood across. I guess you could damage them or something like that, but you'd probably remove all the oxygen, certainly. You wouldn't have an effective oxygenator. Your arterial blood would not be arterialized.
Yeah, once you have blood inside your fibers, I think you're done with that oxygenator.
Yeah, I don't think you could pull the blood across the fibers.
No.
Unless you fractured.
Yeah, unless they
you'd
broke,
have to break
collapsed
them.
And broke or
yeah,
something. Yeah.
Collapsed them and broke them. But I've seen that happen before. I don't know what effect it would have. But if anybody's out there, let's hope. Yeah, get the phone lines open. If somebody wants to call in and ask, or maybe add to this discussion,
that would
be fantastic.
I would love to hear how people are scavenging and what kind of protocols are in place for that, because, you know, honestly, we don't have those. So, I mean, you know, it's I'm surprised after learning what I learned how loose it is, you know. It really shouldn't be that loose as far as, and I'm more concerned for people in the operating room than anything else. I mean, we're doing it every day, every single day, breathing something that we know can cause all kinds of problems for us, you know.
Well, I've been breathing it for years.
I know.
I mean,
me too.
A long time. And I, you know, I do have a couple of those symptoms.
We all do.
The irritability seems pretty, you know, better go to who you talk to. I don't think I've become more irritable over the years. I think I've become less. So,
someone's laughing.
That was really not appropriate. Okay. There's a question on Facebook. Hold on. Let's see. Let's see what that was not appropriate. My producer just laughed at that comment. Too much negative pressure would cause, for example, premature plasma leakage. Probably so. But I think plasma leakage occurs, though, usually, isn't it, the lipids, and you have to change it from being naturally hydrophobic to hydrophilic, and then it swells and the pores dilate. You know, they get larger because the membrane material itself is swelling. You know, I don't know, Pedro, that you may be right. What about systems like Fluoroabsorb? Are they 100% secure? Another question.
Fluoroabsorb?
It's called Fluoroabsorb.
Okay, so I ran into that.
Here we go.
On the internet when I was doing my research, and it is a product that is an in the room filter. and you know they say it works. So I guess if you don't have any kind of way of scavenging this out of your operating room, or you're uncomfortable with just showing, you know, throwing it up into the atmosphere, there are products out there to scavenge it in the room.
So it sounds to me, Pedro, do you use FluoroAbsorb? Can you type that to him, Magic? Ask him if he uses it.
If I'm thinking of the right thing.
Or what his system is for using it. Yeah, I think you would just damage the lung. I think you would damage it. I'm not sure, you know, plasma leakage, I thought, occurred. You know, you have to get the pore size has to be big enough for plasma to come through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can only happen if it's not put enough negative pressure. I think you can break them, and I think you're going to have a blood leak.
Yeah, or
You're going to, even if you had just not so much excess vacuum, but enough, you could remove the gas. The gas flow isn't going to, you're not going to oxygenate your blood.
I almost was thinking of trying that, because I don't know what would happen if you had 15 liters of negative pressure across your membrane. You're going to have the gas flow is going to be so quick.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wouldn't try it on a patient, but I'm just curious, you know, if that would affect your...
Yeah, good. I'm glad you said
that. Would have less
time
that the oxygen, you know, would be exposed to the fiber, so I would think you would decrease your oxygenation.
But you'd have a constant flow of it.
You would have a constant flow, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good question. Yes, we use it. So, Pedro, does it in fact work 100%? Is it very easy to use? You want to call in, you can call in. It works with an activated carbon filter. Yeah, okay. So, you know, exit through?
I think they
it?
Hook it to the exit of the oxygenator. Is that true? I'd love it if Pedro could call in or
Pedro,
let us know
if there's any
that,
way you can
works.
Call in, it would be fantastic, because then you can tell us.
I didn't really want to feature a product on my presentation, but if somebody wants to call in and talk about what they're using, I think
that'd be
great.
Fantastic. Yeah. But I do think we should be doing it. We can look this up when we have a chance, and we'll... thanks very much for the answers. We didn't really help you. I don't think we answered. You told us. We learned more from you than you learned from us on that one, Pedro. But I just simply don't know.
Yeah.
But I think we should look into this, because if there is a way to just have it exiting, going through this activated charcoal filter, or carbon filter rather, yeah, the same thing, and then being able to just disperse into the atmosphere, and it's removed this material, or has removed it enough to make it insignificant, that would seem to me the safest way to do it versus having it go into a suction canister where you have that risk of excess pressurization.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to make sense to me.
It'd be more passive.
But then you would have to not have a Y, put your Y connector back up, throw the slides back up, that last slide. So on that image that you have there, wherever your last slide, there it is.
There it is.
He had it. Yeah. So so if you have that on vacuum, you're going to preferentially pull from the path of least resistance,
right,
unless you had it just too high. And then it's just excessive. I don't know, but if you occluded it, that'd be where the problem came in. But, you know, if you had that thing like that, only you didn't have that Y, you would still have that same fear of possibly occluding it, which is catastrophic. So you almost have to have that. And if it's passive, it has to be hooked up to suction, because it's passive, then it's going to also go the path of least resistance, then it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, I'm watching you from Portugal. I can't call. My daughters are sleeping. Next bedroom, sorry. Don't worry about it. But I'll tell you what, Pedro, we're going to have to do a program again. We're going to have to do another program, and we're going to have to get you on the program from Portugal. We'll have to do it at a different time when it's a more civilized hour for you. And we'll go from there. But welcome, and thank you so much for bringing this to us, because it's stimulating more thought at the end of the day.
Sure.
You know, so now we're going to have to explore this even deeper. So, Pedro, we're going to schedule a program around your schedule so we can air it and get you on the program, okay? But it definitely is something, Patrick, I think needs to be done. So you ready for the poll results?
I can't wait.
Let's reveal. Let's do the poll reveal. 68% do, 32%, so basically two-thirds do, one-third don't.
Yep.
And that actually surprises me.
What did you expect?
90-10.
90 scavenging?
Don't.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would have expected it to be higher.
I'm happy with the number of people who responded.
Yeah, me too. Actually, we had some on YouTube as well. Do you have the YouTube one? Because
yes.
We did two different polls. We did the Slido and we did YouTube.
29% yes.
29% yes. 71
no.
Really? The
no.
YouTubers
so the
are like...
But what number? How many people responded?
Seven, we have a phone call.
Seven, phone call, okay.
Oh, seven respondents. Okay, so that's a little different. That's
okay, go ahead. You're out live on the air.
Hey, Joe and Patrick. It's John Ingram one more time.
Hey,
I only
John.
Have about five minutes.
Hey, John.
I definitely learned a few things. And I was gonna call and try to be a spoiler on the poll. And I was going to say it was 80-20 because about one in five places, as you know, I travel around. One in five I have seen do not. And I'm surprised it's even worse than that on your poll. And based on what Patrick's saying there about, I actually thought the patient received 90% of the gas and only 10% of it came out of our exhaust. I never thought it was nearly this high. Thank God I've always been scavenging.
Yeah, I'm sure of that statistic. I looked at it several times. I was surprised as well.
That is very surprising. Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It's very surprising to me.
So did we change your mind, John?
Well, I've always scavenged, thank God.
Oh, yeah, okay, good.
Gone. But some places I went, they didn't have it. They just didn't have it there, and so no. There
right.
was times when it just wasn't set up, and all the perfusionists just were basically drinking the Kool-Aid that it wasn't necessary, and I... To be honest with you, I wasn't as educated as you just presented on this topic, so I'm really glad you did this. But what I wanted to ask Patrick real quick, and I only have a few minutes too left, is when the hospitals, when you hook it up to the wall vacuum, which I basically see everywhere, I was assuming that it went out into the hospital's vacuum system and either went out into the environment or it got scavenged by some type of filter device machine thing that you were talking about. Is that the two things that can happen, or is there a third option?
Well, you got to dig pretty deep in the, I ended up looking at, schematics for hospitals and things like that, but basically what it comes down to is there is no regulation as to where it goes other than it has to be 10 feet, the exhaust has to be 10 feet from an entrance or any hole into the building. So that's really all the regulation is. Now, there are hospitals who are using systems to, as we mentioned, to recycle the gases. But the stuff that you are putting right into the wall suction, that really just goes right out.
Outside into the environment.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the places that I've seen where they don't do it, and I ask the people there, do you guys scavenge? Oh, no. The reasons I've always been given were... Well, it's just so little that comes out of the oxygenator. The room is recycled. The air in the room is turned over every 3, 4, 5 minutes, whatever, different rooms, depending on the system they have,
right.
How much the entire room air is turned over.
Yeah.
And the amount it would actually reach an individual person, let's say a scrub nurse on the other side of the table, would be so microscopic that it really doesn't matter. That's what I've always heard everywhere. And so I think that's not accurate based on what you've presented here today.
Well, I have to say, we're only running it at, 1 or 2% during the case. So, there's probably some truth to that. It's not a high amount. I've never smelled it unless I turn it up real high. So.
Well, what percentage does anesthesia run? What percentage do they run?
I talked to them about that. They actually run a little higher than we do. They start off at 4% during induction. So they're a little higher than we are.
That's not much different when you consider 90% of it is being
true.
Theirs is all being
yeah.
Ours is going into the room. So
right.
I mean, if we're at 2 and they're at 4, I mean that's still a pretty significant amount. It's not like they're running some 50% and we're running 2% or something. But
right.
If you're saying that they do 4%. And we're doing 2. I mean, sometimes people run 3, but a lot of places do run 1% too. Now that you say that,
right? So when you're
what is the reason why so little of it? Is it because the molecular size doesn't go through our fibers very well? Why is so little of it going to the patient?
I can't answer why, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But I do know it's the same in the lungs as it is through the oxygenator. So it's something with the gas. It's not something with the oxygenator.
So you may have to have a percentage, John. There may need to be a A concentration yeah. to get the therapeutic effect, and that concentration has to be higher, you know, in order, like that percentage, in order just to get 10% of it to transfer over.
Mm-hmm. Could be, yeah.
There's a word for that. Yeah, I'll just have a word for that. Now that you say that, and it doesn't come to mind. There's a word for the effective minimum percentage in the world of anesthesia, and I've seen it, and
MAC.
I've had a discussion before.
You're talking about MAC.
What?
Minimal alveolar concentration,
yes,
MAC.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, you need a MAC of 1 or a MAC of point, you know, whatever your MAC is.
Right.
So if you get below that, you don't even have anywhere near enough to be therapeutic, I'm assuming. Is that what that level means?
Yes. I'm not an anesthetist, but, you know, that's what I understand from my rudimentary understanding of anesthesia, is that you just have to have a minimum alveolar concentration, and that depends on the inhalation agent that you're using to have therapeutic effect.
So, hey, John, I wanted to ask you before you go, where are you scavenging to? And just describe your system, if you could.
Everywhere that I've ever been, as far as I'm known, for perfusion, it's always gone to the wall. I don't think I've ever seen it any other way that I can think of. What would happen if you scavenged it to the Neptune?
I didn't hear the question.
Through the
where
Neptune. What if
it's
through
the
Neptune?
You know, the Neptune. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
That
Neptune's got they clearly have a filter in there. Whether it would remove anesthesia gases, I don't know if it's a
gas,
carbon
though,
filter.
Maybe not for anesthesia gas. It's probably, if people are doing that, thinking they're accomplishing something, my guess would be there may be a HEPA filter, some type of bacteriostatic or dust filter, but.
Right.
To trap an anesthesia gas would have to be specific for that, wouldn't you think?
I would think so, because the system that we just heard described from Pedro was a carbon filter.
Yeah, carbon filter. And I think I would.
Activated carbon.
I'm going to look into this fluoroabsorb and learn more about that. I think that's something I want to know more about.
So do you have just sort of a wide system that we showed, or do you regulate?
Yeah, but exactly. I mean, well, some people just cut a giant side hole in the main, they have one suction tubing coming straight to the exhaust. If you cut a giant side hole in the side of your suction tubing, it sort of accomplishes the same thing. But with the Y, it's better, but I would suggest something. I don't think you should have that little extra 6-inch piece of tubing coming off the Y. You should leave it without the tubing on it.
Right.
So that therefore nobody could step on it. If it's just an open Y, if somebody steps on it, they'd break your connector, but at least it wouldn't occlude it, right? So I would always do it without that little 6-inch sub tubing on the end of that Y.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, that's smart.
Right.
That's smart. Okay, and do you have any idea what would happen? What would happen if you put excessive vacuum on your gas phase of your oxygenator? Do you know?
No, I don't. It's a very good question. I don't know. I think you guys hit it. I think you could, if it was. Well, remember, let's say you have 4 liters of gas flow and 15 mm-hmm. liters of suction, right? So I don't know. Would you tend to get more? Would it pull your gas flow more? But then at the same time, I think you would have so little dwell time of the gas sweeping through your fibers that you would be very poor oxygenating, for one thing. And at some point, you probably would definitely pull fluid across, I would think.
Yeah.
I don't see how you wouldn't.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
Right. Appreciate your call. Thanks.
All right. Bye, guys.
Thanks, John. Okay. Well, very good. I thought that was an excellent. I want to learn more about fluoroabsorb.
Yeah.
We need to get Pedro and John on a program.
Yes.
And we need to get an anesthetist or anesthesiologist, either one. I prefer an anesthetist to come over. Actually, Dr. Samir.
Sure.
He's an anesthesiologist. He's one mm-hmm. of the few I really like. we could get him on here.
Yeah.
And because he probably knows quite a bit about this
topic.
I'm sure
he does, yeah.
Will you commit to doing a part two to this?
Next call.
Okay.
Yes, I would.
Hello, you're live on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Stephanie.
Oh, hey, Stephanie.
Hi, this is Stephanie.
Hey, Steph.
Hey, guys. Okay, first, I'm going to put on my phone. Hey, I missed the beginning of your presentation. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
So I don't know if you guys have addressed this or not. I was wondering, when you were looking up everything, if you came across seeing that I've been reading some things where people are saying we should scavenge during our ECMO runs with the COVID to blow off anything blowing out of our oxygenator. Have you seen that, or do you guys think that's a good idea?
I don't know that you could. I think you need to have respiratory droplets. I don't think you can transmit the virus that way.
It would be coming from the blood through our oxygenator.
Exhaust.
So basically any of that fluid blowing out of the oxygenator. I think I saw where companies were sending that notice that it's a possibility out
really?
Of oxygenator.
Is that'd be mostly for ECMO we're talking about, I assume?
Yeah, that's right.
A COVID ECMO patients where if you were containing that and blowing it out, you'd have less risk of that fluid that's accumulating, dropping out of our oxygenator, like going into the air, the floor.
But wouldn't
just wondering
that be,
what you guys think.
But wouldn't that be the same if it was influenza B?
Yeah, so that's my question too. Should be doing that for all of those types of patients
that are
infected.
What you bring up, though, is interesting because, you know, many people are scavenging in the operating room because they're trying to scavenge these gases out, right? But are people scavenging, you know, in an ECMO situation in an ICU for other reasons? And probably not. So,
I kind of heard a little bit about it, I think, on Facebook, you know, and I was just wondering if anyone knew anything of it and if we should be doing that.
That's a really good question.
It's a good question.
Oh, and I also...
I don't know.
I agree with the last caller also that you should not have any tubing on the end of that connector, so that's just a hard, open connection that has less possibility of kinking off. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, did you answer the poll question?
No, I was cooking dinner and I tuned in too late.
It's been there for 2 weeks. It's been there
so
for 2 weeks. It's been there for 2 weeks.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So the question is, do you or do you not scavenge
you can ask her.
Your anesthetic gas from the gas outlet port, your exhaust port on your oxygenator on every case?
Okay, so I'm going to be honest. Patrick did an excellent job on his presentation from what I saw, and I asked him to do the presentation because we are not currently doing it, and I would like to... get some input on that and start doing it in our group.
I think we should.
I admitted to Joe before and during the show that, you know, doing this research convinced me to scavenge for my own health, if nothing else.
I appreciate you doing this, Patrick.
Right.
Well, good. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you, Stephanie. Thank you so very much. And I think Patrick has agreed to come in and do a part two. And I think, you know, I'd like to make sure we support him on that and really put together something maybe a little more robust, do it on a weekend, have more people here, maybe try to get a hold of somebody from CDC or from that other organization.
Oh, that'd be cool. Yeah.
Try to communicate with Pedro. I'll get you his Facebook name right here. He's on our list. And maybe do a bigger program on this topic because I think it's a really, I was surprised that it was 30%, a third basically are not. And that when you consider how many heart surgeries are done in this country, that's a pretty high number.
It is a lot, yeah.
And then how are they doing it? What's the best way? What is this best safe? What's the safest way to do it? What are some of the hidden risks or the hidden things that can happen that go bad.
Yeah, I always like it when somebody says, I always like it when somebody says, oh, you know, this happened to me once and that's, you know, watch out for that. I mean, that's always helpful.
Those are very helpful.
Me too.
Okay, very good.
Well,
thank you, Stephanie.
I think one of the best systems I saw when I asked people to send pictures was this, the Boehringer vacuum where it actually had a flow dial for negative pressure, so
yes.
You could set it.
Yeah, the Boehringer, I think it is. Yes, I'm familiar with that company. They're up in Dallas, I think. And they have it for auto transfusion. Yeah, and you can use it, you can actually use that regulator, Boehringer Labs, maybe that's what it's called, but you can, I can't remember how you say it.
Okay.
Yeah, but you can have more than, like it can handle more than one device. And it's a really neat tool and how it works. I don't know how their price is, but I think we just need to look at it and consider, you know, the cost benefit ratio. Is there another way fluoroabsorb that they're using in Portugal that Pedro is using, maybe the thing that we need be very simple to use. I don't know if it's reusable, disposable, I really don't know, but we're gonna look into it and find out.
Sure.
Great. So, thanks for doing this talk, guys.
Oh, thanks.
Great
job. Thanks for the call. We got another call? Okay, we got another caller, okay. Dude, you're popular.
I know, this is
nobody
great.
Ever, hey, lots of calls. You're live on the air.
Oh, hey, Joe, this is another Joe calling.
Hey, Joe.
Which Joe is this?
This is Joe Valachinas. I'm in California. And listening to your talk, thanks, Peter, that was awesome. We've been thinking about kind of similar things. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up was that we started using that Barnard device, and it's pretty slick because it, not only can you use it for a vac assist, but you can also use it for your gas vacuum.
Wait, say that again.
You're using the fluoroabsorb?
Well, I never used that, but the Boehringer device, for your vac assist.
Yeah.
And you can use it for your gas exchanges.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that you can use that Boehringer regulator on multiple devices. I don't know if it's more than two, but I know you can use it on two.
What we do is the flow meter for it, we use it at a lower level than what we're passing through, so it's not going to pull more necessarily.
Yeah, that's it. And is it by pressure or flow?
Well, it's by you can adjust the flow. So if we're flowing at 3 liters, we'll do it like, you know, 1.5 or 2 or something like that.
Right, got it. That makes a lot of sense. And do you send that to, like, so do you use the same regulator for your vacuum assist venous drainage and that, or do you
have two? Right, that's what that device does. Oh. That's for both.
Gotcha. Yes, that's what I've heard. Yeah, okay. That it can do that. And that's kind of neat that it does that.
The problem is it's not cheap. It's fairly, but we were working on some new devices, so we were able to get it in, and I think it's a great device.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if it's worth it, it's worth it, right?
I agree.
What do you do with it when you're, like, do you suck it into a vacuum one of the canisters, and then it eventually takes it out of the system, or is there a special place that you have
so
it go?
Right now we do what most people are doing, and I think it goes into, we have a boom, it goes into the boom vacuum system, and then we take it out. I do think we have the waste anesthesia gas, but I'm going to look into maybe that's where we should be taking it, because that's a great point. I don't know if they recycle that or not, but I'm going to look into that now. Because that makes a lot of sense.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Very good. Dude, those are all really good points. And Joe, listen, we've got John Ingram, we've got Patrick, we've got Stephanie. Now we have Joe from California. You know, that's going to be a great program.
Hey, one other thing I wanted to mention is in another webinar, I'm pretty sure they said they've got some positive COVID results out of the ECMO exhaust. So they're recommending... from what I remember.
Yeah, that's hard for me to believe that, though, to be honest with you, because there is, I mean, we went through this with blood transfusions, that it's not transmittable through blood transfusions. So they're not testing everybody that goes in for COVID that's donating blood. So you can be asymptomatic, not tested, not diagnosed, give blood, and they're saying there is no transmission risk, mm-hmm. because the blood bank's, of course, very concerned about not having enough blood supply for the demand. And so
the question is, are we getting it from the gas exchange, possibly, since it's not coming through the blood, maybe it's coming through the gas that we're pulling off. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, but supposedly they were seeing some positive results.
Yeah, I find that very hard to believe, because really that moisture that you see is basically, mm-hmm. you know, it's thermal sweat, right? It's just condensation. It's not really a it's not truly a respiratory droplet. So I have a hard time believing that, but look, we can explore it. Let's find out. But I think if you cannot transmit it via blood transfusion and the same,
right.
look,
I've heard it's
you know,
not
then
from
I don't
blood,
think.
So.
Yeah, then I don't believe that you could transmit it through the exhaust gas of your membrane, of your oxygenator for ECMO. I don't believe so. But of course, let's be sure. Let's find out the facts. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. So I'll, you know, make sure that I qualify
right.
that. But it just doesn't make
because
sense.
Because I'd rather scavenge than not, and then find out later on that for some reason it did pass through.
No, that's true too. Of course, you're better safe than sorry. So I'm gonna get on this. I think there is an answer.
Bottom line is your anesthesia vent, if you're running an ECMO, is ventilated into it's exhausting out of the room.
Yes,
but your oxygenator isn't.
Right.
So
right.
I'm not saying that means you could
right,
be infected.
Well,
I'm just saying it's the truth.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody is scavenging during ECMO, because they're only worried about anesthesia gases, which we're not using during ECMO.
Right. I would think if you could do that, I would think that if that were really truly a possibility, it would have been, I think the alarm bells would have been ringing really loud. But look, we're gonna explore it. We're gonna schedule another program. I'm gonna communicate, Patrick's gonna communicate with you and Pedro and Stephanie and John Ingram. And when this whole thing is over and we're able to, you know, really get together, we're going to get you guys out here. Now, the trip from Portugal is going to be kind of long for Pedro, but no, it's all right. California is not so hard to get to Houston. But we're going to have a big event here and bring in some you guys plus some additional experts and see if we can really put this thing together and get some good information out there.
Hey, that's
better idea. Definitive.
Why don't we all meet in Hawaii or something instead? Let's just all meet in Hawaii.
Okay, well, we could do that too if you want to. All right, but let's wait till this crisis is over. Since I do think it is over, you know, I don't know what you guys are doing out there. California seems to have done pretty well. We've had three.
We've been lucky. I think for the most part, people have been, you know, adhering to the social distancing. You know, we have cases, but we are very fortunate not to be like New York. Not
yes.
even close.
Yeah. Well, why? Why did that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of theories. I'm going to be interested to see what it ends up being. It almost, you know, given what happened in Italy and what happened in New York and to some degree Michigan versus what happened in California, South Korea, possibly Wuhan, where everybody says they don't believe their numbers, and then down in Miami, it makes me wonder if it wasn't two different viruses. You know, it just because the
well, you know, they talk about the strain from the East Coast coming from Europe. And the West Coast strain coming from China, so it's possible that's more virulent.
Yeah, and that mutated just a little bit between the two places,
right.
Maybe an indistinguishable amount enough to make it a higher level of virulence. I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Joe, do me a favor so that I can stay in touch with
you.
Send me an email at contact@perfusioneducation.com so that because I've got Pedro, I know John Ingram already. I want to make sure that I get your contact information so that we can stay in touch and collaborate on this project.
Well, I'm one of the few guys that actually has more years than you do, so I don't know if you want that, that's fine.
How many years you got?
I'm just over 40.
Uh-huh. I'm on my 43rd.
Well, I thought you said 39 the other day.
No, I say I'm 39 years old. No, I graduated, if you include my training, it's longer than that. I graduated in 79. So come the end of May, I start my 43rd year. I'm finishing up my 42nd year right now. So I graduated
in
79.
I'm right about there because Yeah, we're right about the same thing. I actually got certified in 81, but I was actually pumping in 79.
Yeah, okay. Did you get certified in Philly? Wait, 81 was, yeah, it was Philadelphia.
The orals, I did the orals in San Francisco, and the writtens were in Philly's in 80.
Yes, okay, so you and I were at that same meeting.
Wow.
Yeah.
You and I were at that same meeting. That's where I did my orals, was in Philadelphia.
No,
he did his orals in San Francisco.
No, he said he did his written in San Francisco. Oh, it was the opposite?
Yeah,
no, it doesn't matter, but I did the written in Philadelphia. The orals were in San Francisco.
Okay. Well, you were doing your written. Well, I did both the written and the oral, both at the same time, both in Philadelphia.
There you go. You could have been there.
Mm.
So I think we were at the same place. I remember the hotel.
Might have been. That was 1980.
Yes. Do you remember the crazy party that they had out at the pool?
I do remember having a good time. I know that much.
Yeah, I have a feeling. I'm not going to say it on the air, but do you remember F. Michael Burgess?
I know Michael very well. He was out here in California, and he helped me do some covers.
Absolutely. F. Michael Burgess, because he was at that same pool party in Philadelphia in 1980 at the hotel.
We used to call him the Albumin Man.
Yep, Albumin Man. Absolutely. And he was from Catalina Island, one of the few people from Catalina Island, because there's not a lot of residents there.
He would sail over there, and
yeah. Yeah, man, good times, dude. We need to get together. We're going to Hawaii. Patrick, pack your bags.
Right.
Tell Julie.
I'm going.
All right.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys. Appreciate your seminar there.
Don't forget to send me an email, Joe, please.
All right, sounds good.
Promise me,
all right?
All right, bye. Well, this was pretty doggone lively.
It was.
This was great. Great topic, Patrick. Congratulations and good job.
I'm surprised it went so well. Thanks.
Absolutely. Social distancing. Yep. So we'll just do like that. There you go. Air pump.
Air pump. Yeah.